You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, February 21st, 2022. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Steeder for the week, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Diva Woodley, associate professor of politics at the New School for Social Research and author of Reckoning, Black Lives Matter, and the Democratic Necessity of Social Movements. Meanwhile, Emmanuel Macron is moonlighting as a couples therapist on the international stage. Biden has, in principle, agreed to meet with Putin to discuss Ukraine. Doesn't particularly help that Zelensky is now being vocal about preemptive sanctions and an expanded NATO membership. Domestic posturing with international implications. U.S. COVID cases and hospitalizations continue their steady decline. Yesterday just broke 100,000 cases after 800,000 new cases were reported a little over 5 weeks ago. So that's not even a steady decline. That's a precipitous drop. Good news for now. And the Biden administration is reportedly increasing assistance for vaccine production in 11 African nations. Only 12% of the African population is vaccinated. Yet another way for Western powers to give crumbs instead of just waiving the patents. Politico was reporting that Biden is actively looking for GOP support for whoever he nominates to the Supreme Court. Why? No one knows, but it does add credence to my fear that Clyburn's push for anti-labor candidate J. Michelle Childs is working. Former police officer Kim Potter was sentenced to 2 years in prison for killing Duante Wright during a traffic stop. She claimed she confused her gun for a taser. And lastly, New York City Mayor Eric Adams and Governor Kathy Hochul are implementing a zero-tolerance policy for homeless individuals sleeping on subway cars in the dead of winter. Good for them. All this and more on today's program. Welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen, and everybody else as well. I don't identify as a lady. I mean, that's a little too proper for me. I'm back for this President's Day, I should say. I'm going to be hosting the show solo this week while Sam is out on vacation. I went to my cousin's bachelorette party, more like a going away where we played a lot of board games and did temporary tattoos. So if you see this, I did not get tatted up this weekend. I mean, they're really ugly. I would like to think that if I do end up getting a tattoo that I'm going to go with something a little bit better. What I have on right now, but yeah, that's the blotch that you might be seeing on my arm. Everybody else have a good weekend here?
Yeah, I'd say a pretty good weekend. Honestly, I don't like NBA All-Star weekend because there's frankly not enough basketball.
And so it's not real basketball.
I don't like it. Yeah. I feel weird.
All right. And Bradley's nearing his birthday's coming up. So we're in the countdown mode, here at the Majority Report. Everybody wish Saturday, so wish Bradley a preemptive happy birthday in the chat if you can. But let's turn to this Ukraine story, which continues to dominate the news cycle, even though a lot of it is conjecture. But I do think it's helpful to get some of this context so there's a greater understanding of what's happening here. Late last week and over the weekend, the U.S. claimed that Russia was lying about its claim that it withdrew some thousands of troops from Ukraine's border. Now, luckily, despite that hiccup, Emmanuel Macron appears to have been able to get Putin and Biden to the table. Apparently, there's a tepid agreement on a scheduled meeting about this conflict, all while Ukrainian President Zelensky, who frankly seems pretty over his head, or in over his head, is now publicly pleading for preemptive sanctions, echoing what the U.S. war hawks have been saying, and for an expedited NATO expansion and inclusion of Ukraine into NATO, both of which would dramatically increase the prospects of war. Now, this is different from what Zelensky has said in the past. He's trying to appear tough on the domestic front. So hopefully Biden doesn't take him too seriously. And it seems like he isn't, because Zelensky, as of now, isn't, it's a party of three and then maybe four with Boris Johnson, Macron, Biden, and Putin. But as we've mentioned on this program, we can trace all of what's happening now to the U.S. reneging on its promise not to allow Ukraine into NATO. Bush promised he'd do so on the way out, on his way out the door, which kind of echoes what Trump did in regards to Yemen, classifying the Houthis as a terrorist organization, which has grave implications as he was leaving office, just because the war hawks need a little bit of a gift after you're leaving power. Curry some favor with them if you ever want to work for, I don't know, some fancy think tank, although I guess presidents are above that. But regardless, you got to repay the neocons. So Bush did that, I believe, in 2008. NATO had already allowed many countries on the border of Russia into NATO. It started as a dozen nations, rapidly expanded to 30, including other former Soviet states, Estonia, the Czech Republic, Latvia. And Ukraine is obviously a former part of the Soviet Union, but it's also much larger than many of those nations that I just listed. And it's right on the border of Russia, shares a large swath of the country's border. So there's a lot of shared space there, which is why this is such a big deal. So not only has the U.S. built up a 30-nation military alliance with multiple nations on Russia's border in the wake of the Cold War as a way to flex our muscle, the U.S. has been dangling this threat over their head to add another much larger nation to this military alliance after promising we wouldn't do so with Gorbachev. He got assurances that this wouldn't happen. The U.S. lied, and here we are now. So in terms of the context, it's also important to understand that someone like Zelensky does have to juggle the fact that there are still Ukrainians in his country that want to be a part of Russia, a larger nation with more prestige, particularly in areas like Donbass, which is right on the border there. However, with all that said, avoiding all bloodshed is the number one, number two, number three priority. The point is just that is the context for why Russia is posturing in this way and attempting to look strong in this area, because the reason that this is even a conflict in the first place is because the United States lied and broke its promise. And the other larger context is that all of these leaders are operating in their own way for domestic reasons. But Russia's chest puffing and military exercises are underpinned by that history. There's a fundamental mistrust of U.S. arrogance, which results in lies, broken promises. And they, as a nation with a bit more of a history, Russia has a fairly clear-eyed understanding of how bloated and incompetent our leadership is when it comes to specifically international policy, which we only know how to respond with brute military force, aggression, and a bumbling desire to make sure that we're the superpower for all of eternity, which is not going to happen. There is a ruling class in this country, our politicians, who refuse to acknowledge that we're on the decline. And it results in bungled answers, nonsensical stuff, like what we saw from Kamala Harris. So that is a long prelude to this clip by Kamala Harris asked about Putin, Ukraine, and the prospect of economic sanctions. She gives two answers in one.
But if you believe Putin has made up his mind, what leverage do you really have? Why not put those sanctions in place now?
The purpose of the sanctions has always been and continues to be deterrence. But let's also recognize the unique nature of the sanctions that we have outlined. These are some of the greatest sanctions, if not the strongest, that we've ever issued. As I articulated yesterday, it is directed at institutions, in particular financial institutions, and individuals, and it will exact absolute harm for the Russian economy and their government.
But if Putin has made up his mind, do you feel that this threat that has been looming is really going to deter him?
Absolutely. We strongly believe, and remember also that the sanctions are a product not only of our perspective as the United States, but a shared perspective among our allies. And the allied relationship is such that we have agreed that the deterrence effect of these sanctions is still a meaningful one, especially because, remember also, we still sincerely hope that there is a diplomatic path out of this moment. And within the context then of the fact that that window is still opening, although it is absolutely narrowing,
jeez,
but within the context of a diplomatic path still being open, the deterrence effect, we believe, has merit.
I mean, I don't understand how she's this bad at this at this point. She's contradicting herself in her answer there and in the United States' position that Russia has already invaded. Now, again, there are reports, of course, of shelling of parts of eastern Ukraine right now, which is something I completely and categorically denounce. But the point is that sanctions cannot be a deterrent if you're already claiming that an invasion is imminent or an invasion is happening. Very muddled response from her there. I still maintain that a lot of this is posturing. And I don't know if this is a controversial thing to say. My framing was a bit controversial. My point is just that the United States is treated with unseriousness because we have deserved and earned that reputation. And that is part of the context here. This was why, and again, with Crimea and now here, there is, I don't like military action in any way, but there are members of the population in both of those areas of Ukraine, well, now Crimea is gone, that want to be a part of Russia. And that's a part of the context that you'll never get in the United States.
I would recommend folks check out the American Prestige most recent episode on the apparent Russian escalation the past few days. They have the Derek Davison has a good mea culpa there, which basically says, you know, I think especially from the left, there's been too much of a collapsing into there's going to be nothing that happens versus there's going to be an invasion of Kiev, for instance. And Davison says, you know, occupying regions like the Donbass that are frankly like
pro-Russian,
that is something that they said, you know, they may be undersold as a possibility, like in the response to the, you know, the overt giant invasion stuff that we've all been hearing. I think that's worthwhile to note.
And the United States benefits from an increase in more intense rhetoric about like Kiev is about to get bombed any second now, as opposed to there's still a lot of gray area, especially along eastern Ukraine.
Yeah. I don't like, Blinken and those folks, I think part of them, and this is an urgent situation, but also, it's something to talk about that isn't taking money from the Afghan treasury or starving kids domestically, which is, I think, things that I would like to talk more about than this stuff, because I think it's in the fog of war, frankly, and I think it's hard to have an accurate assessment of what's going on.
Right, which is why I mean, you know, historical context, I think, is what should be at the forefront. What should be at the forefront here? Regardless, we are going to take a quick break. But first, we have a wonderful sponsor for you. The new year is here, and there's no better way to kick off 2022 than making sure you're feeling like your best self. And that includes staying hydrated with Liquid IV. One stick of Liquid IV in 16 ounces of water hydrates faster and more efficiently than water alone. Plus, Liquid IV has incredible hydration flavors like watermelon, lemon, lime, strawberry, pina colada, and more. Acai, my personal favorite. Although I do really like the strawberry and the watermelon as well. Sam is partial to the pina colada, as he'll remind you if he was here. He would remind you of that. Liquid IV contains five essential vitamins, B3, B5, B6, B12, and vitamin C. So if you're feeling a little run down, this is perfect for you. With Liquid IV, you can get three times the electrolytes of traditional sports drinks. If like the weird color of Gatorade and the chemicaliness freaks you out, or other kind of drinks like that, maybe not them specifically, this is perfect for you. Liquid IV is made with premium ingredients and is non-GMO and free from gluten, dairy, and soy. The science of cellular transport technology is what makes Liquid IV so effective. It's designed to enhance rapid absorption of water and other key ingredients into the bloodstream. And I will say, I regularly use Liquid IV. I've gotten my family on it. When you're maybe like, oh, I got a little bit of a cold, you want an infusion of nutrients, and you won't need to stay hydrated if you're traveling or something like that, this is perfect for you. If you have a hangover, it's also helpful. It's all even more effective at preventing a hangover if you remember to take it the night before. I can unfortunately speak to personal experience on both. Once when I forgot, and once when I didn't forget. And remembering is good for you. Grab Liquid IV in bulk nationwide at Costco, or you can get 25% off when you go to liquidiv.com and use code MajorityRep at checkout. That is MajorityRep. That's 25% off anything you order when you use promo code MajorityRep at liquidiv.com. Experience better hydration today at liquidiv.com. Promo code MajorityRep. We are back, and we are joined right now by Diva Woodley, Associate Professor of Politics at the New School for Social Research and author of Reckoning Black Lives Matter and the Democratic Necessity of Social Movements. Diva, thank you so much for being with us today.
A pleasure to be here. Thank you.
I'm excited to dive into this. I want to talk a lot about radical black feminist pragmatism, but one, I did appreciate how your book kind of, in the first chapter, you go right into it with this 2016 Obama quote about Black Lives Matter, which is, to be frank, dripping with condescension, pretty much. And it's also wrong, as you write. So let's just start there. Talk a little bit about what he said at that time period, and how, and if his misconception is indicative of a larger collective misconception about activism in general.
Yes. So at that time, and I can't remember the exact quote, but President Obama said something, gave a quote to the newspaper that said something like, you know, activism is about getting a seat at the table. But once you have been invited to the table, then you need to sit down and, you know, basically talk to the power holders and power brokers. And, you know, at the time, I do think that there's some condescension in the quote, but I also think that it is all a general idea that is shared by a large majority of, you know, the citizenry, the polity, is that activism is about making noise, but then as soon as you're invited into the halls of power, then it's about sort of brokering deals. And while there is some part of that that is correct, meaning that one should be negotiating for the things that one wants, Another part of it is a complete misconception of what social movements are all about, right? Social movements are not just about brokering deals with current power holders. It's about reconfiguring power, right? So that is something that has to happen by an outside-inside strategy. You can't be entirely captured by power holders because they are going to tend to want to keep things the same, because it is under those conditions which they secured their power, right? But the point of social movements is to say that there are people who aren't being represented, and more profoundly, that the way that power and privilege is currently arranged is not adequate. And so that is something that has to, a call that has to come from outside the house.
Right. And I mean, the concept of reconfiguring power, I was about to comment on this and you just said it. That's not something that somebody currently in power is interested in. You don't want to shake the boat or rock the boat if it's your boat, or if you're in the boat. And, to me, that also strikes a chord with just general debates around electoralism versus movement building, and how, it's quite convenient for certain very loud voices in power to conceive of activism, as you say. It's not about leveraging your power and holding on to it. It's about, okay, make your point and hand it off to the managers, which really does just serve the entrenched interests of our current system, obviously.
Right. A social movement that's successful has to challenge the way that power is, arranged. I mean, that's its purpose. And it's also an important democratic purpose, period, because this is the other sort of major point of the book. There's a reason why the subtitle is The Democratic Necessity of Social Movements, because we've had social movements for as long as we've had democracies. And that's for a reason, because it's a feature, not a bug. Over time, large institutions, any large institution, institutions that have been designed with good goals in mind, according to the most progressive politics, institutions over time become institution serving rather than mission serving. And that's because institutions want to survive, right? Sort of as they are. In order for an institution to be democratic, that is responsible to the changing and evolving needs of the people, there has to be some kind of pull from the outside that says, wait a minute, your institutional tendencies are pulling in a direction that are not serving the mission. And we're here to call you back, right, to account. We're here to call you back toward whatever the constituency, the people, the association need and want out of this institution. And it is by our authority, right, any kind of democratic institution, it is by our authority that you operate at all. And so it is to our authority that you must be accountable. And that's what social movements do. And it's really important, because without social movements, democratic institutions become democratic in name only. They become oligarchic and they become non-responsive. And so social movements are the thing that shakes democratic institutions out of those doldrums, right? Out of that kind of atrophy, and makes it possible for them to continue and for us not to devolve into oligarchy and authoritarianism.
Well, I mean, then that devolution seemed to be on rolling down a hill and unable to be stopped. Really, Black Lives Matter was such a massive movement that was the first in a long time period, that for a first moment where the mass mobilization was so massive.
so large
that it was impossible to ignore. So before we get to the explosion of the movement, I just want to set the context a little bit more. How do you see this as punctuating this kind of end of history rot that seemed to be a part of this bloated U.S. empire that we're living in? I mean, like, I try not to be nihilistic, but we were talking about Russia, Ukraine earlier in the show, and it's from an objective perspective, if you're looking at it as an international actor, it's hard not to look at the United States as quite vulnerable as a superpower, given how precipitously we are declining, and how we've brought that amongst our, on ourselves in many ways by being like liars and bad people on the international stage.
Well, I mean, yes, but here's the thing is that that end of history rot was happening on both the side of power, but also on the side of some citizenry. So this is also an important function of social movements and a really important effect of the Black Lives Matter movement, but also the constellation of other movements that are happening at the same time, right? Environmental justice movements, Marjorie Stoneman Douglas kids, right? The gun safety movement, the various women's gender and abortion rights movements, labor movements, right? All of these movements are sort of happening in a constellation right now. And Black Lives Matter has been the largest and the most successful, I think, at organizing large numbers of people. But it's that organizing that's really important, because the citizenry had also been fooled into this kind of end of history, idea, right? That we could just sort of go on about our lives, that politics didn't really matter to us, that all we needed to do was to work and consume. And the slippage between the idea that working would be enough to consume as much as we needed in order to care for ourselves and the people we cared about became more and more and more stressful. But people had sort of lost the habit of turning to civic and political organizations for answers and to actually address those problems and to demand address from those who had power. And I call that in the book the depoliticization of public life, right? Public life had gone in the sort of 90s and 2000s to be really depoliticized, well, really starting in the 80s, right? To be depoliticized. And what's really necessary for a democratic polity is not only democratic institutions and power holders that are made to be responsive, but a citizenry that knows that they can demand that responsiveness and knows how to do it. So that's another really important part of social movements, is that it helps people remember what it means to be democratic citizens, right? It helps people remember what it means that they are the authority from which all power flows. And that sort of is the job of organizers and organizing, right? It's the way that people understand themselves to be actors, right? Positive, affirmative, like actors in the polity, and not just people who are witnessing power holders make a mess of everything.
Well, it provides the body politic with agency, which That's I right. think is key. What, and I think you touched on this a bit, but I'm asking if you could expand a little bit on how you perceive this current surge in activism versus how is it distinct from the Black civil rights movement of the 60s in terms of national mobilization and also tactics?
Well, I mean, I think that it builds a lot on the mobilizations in the 1960s, in part because, the leaders of this movement that is happening right now learn from the living members of who are called elders in the movement, right? People who were involved in the civil rights and Black power movements of the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, and try to sort of learn some of the lessons that they sort of take with them. And there are a number of things, I think, that this movement has learned and has decided to do differently. And I think that one of them is to really understand themselves as a multi-generational movement that has to be sustainable. This is also where the notion of a politics of care really comes in, and the notion of being a leader-full movement rather than a movement that has one or two charismatic leaders at the top. Right. But instead, the point of the movement is to create this proliferation of leaders and organizations who can move from a bunch of different push points in the polity and also in culture in order to not only sort of push demands, right, policy demands forward, but also to change the common sense of the polity, to change the way that our political problems are understood, defined, and addressed. And so this movement has been working really hard on those fronts in that kind of broader and more expansive way, and very intentionally, because I think that what they learned from the civil rights generation is that it actually will take more than one generation to dismantle, you know, white supremacy, the version of capitalism we have right now, and patriarchy. Right.
And you mentioned politics of care. So I'm wondering if we could go and move into that part of our discussion here. If you could just define that for us, and that clearly seems to be a significant distinction from the civil rights movement of past, based on just understanding things, understanding oppression as traumatic, as opposed to just wrong. Is that a fair characterization of how that's a shift?
Yes. I mean, it's part of it. I mean, I think a really key part of it is that our movements, the civil rights movement, the labor movement, the women's movement, right, the movements of the 20th century, really had this notion that's, I think, was pretty common to the 20th century, that it was all about the cause, right? It was the cause, right? And if people fell down in the battle for the cause, then that was okay, right? Because the cause was the most important thing. But what we know now, right, is that, you know, a part of getting the cause, right, of racial, social, and economic justice to be the characteristics of the political systems of the 21st century is that we have to center care, right? We have to take care of ourselves and each other. The basis, right, of justice politics is that we need to fairly distribute responsibilities for care. Right. And that includes caring for ourselves in our movements as we pursue, right, and build the other world that we believe is possible. So, yes, I think that that is a major difference. It's acknowledging that injustice is traumatic. It is acknowledging that in order to address that trauma, we need to not only address it personally in terms of therapy and wellness practices, but actually address it politically, because the conditions that create so much of our suffering are structural conditions, and we can't heal from that only through like meditation and yoga, right?
or through convictions of murderers of black people. I get like very enraged talking about how sometimes, like, I forget exactly what Biden or Pelosi said after Chauvin was convicted, but just like lauding the historic moment and we're coming off the news that Kim Potter was sentenced to 2 years in prison. I mean, can you just talk about how like empty that appearance of catharsis is? Because it's like a sugar high. It's going to go away in a second, and everything is going to remain.
Right. I mean, that's the issue, right, is that, you know, the system will sacrifice a person or two in order to maintain itself, right? And I mean, the people involved, when I say the system, it sounds very sort of like opaque, but I just mean the people who are involved in the systemic processes that make Black life precarious will make an example here and there, right, of people in order to continue to legitimize the system as it is. But of course, the criminal legal system is not legitimate as it is. The kind of extractive and exploitative capitalism and racialized capitalism that causes the inequalities that create the environment in which violence, harm, poverty, and death are more likely for Black people and other people of color, you know, is not legitimate, right? And so part of what has to happen is making sense of that delegitimation in public, right? And this is also why the politics of abolition is so important. And that's really, really important to emphasize, because I have to say, I started writing this book 5 years ago, and 5 years ago, I was not an abolitionist, right? Like, I was, you know, a kind of liberal reformer, like many people, like most people, right, according to polling on the criminal legal system. But in doing this research, I realized that part of the problem is our entire approach to harm, right? And that we're not actually thinking about what kinds of things cause harm, right? And we're not trying to address the conditions in which harm is most likely. We're instead just trying to punish people, and especially punish people in systematically acceptable ways, which means people who are already disadvantaged on a number of structural markers, in order to sort of allow the system to continue limping on the way it is. While we're not more safe, right? While we're not happier, while we're not more prosperous, right, on the whole. And that's the thing that really, and interestingly, the thing that really allowed me to come into the abolitionist frame of mind was actually the defund the police demand. Because as I was trying to sort of make sense of this demand, for me, as a philosophical pragmatist, that demand made sense on its face. First of all, I didn't know how much of municipal budget, right? That's most of the discretionary funds, right, of municipal, that is city budgets, get spent on police and policing, right? Between 30 and 50% of discretionary funds in municipal budgets on average. And those budgets tend to increase every year. Meanwhile, budgets for schools, recreation, social services, all of those budgets are fair game to get cut, and in many municipalities are cut to almost nothing. And it didn't make sense empirically, right? It didn't make sense from the point of view of the data, because from what we know about safe communities are communities in which people have access to basic needs, have hope for the future, are able to plan, feel like they are there's some stability and some ability to move toward the future that they desire. And none of those things are helped by police. And yet, most of our discretionary funds are poured, right, into these institutions that don't work to create the conditions that we say we want. For me, that's when it really clicked, honestly. I was like, oh, this actually doesn't make logical sense, right? So that means it's a project and a product of something else. It's a project and a product of an ideology that we're all taught from the time that we're very, very small, right? But doesn't appear to be true from the decades of data that we have. So if that's not true for me as a scholar, then that means you have to turn in a really different direction. And that's why the radicalism and the pragmatism for me go together. Right?
Well, because exactly. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
No. Because the radicalism is not about a particular position or set of positions. It's about asking what's at the root of the problem we say we have. And then the pragmatism is, okay, so then what do we have to try in order to fix it? And, in this case, right, shrinking police and punitive forces, right, rethinking how we deal with harm and care overall, these are the things that actually make practical sense if what we say we want is a safer, more prosperous, more well society.
Right. And you say as a scholar, it doesn't, of course, make sense to you. I'm sorry, as a scholar, this is the conclusion that you drew. As a someone that covers politics, I'm coming to that conclusion as well, because I see police budgets and the way that they exercise their power as soft fascism. And sometimes it's just fascism. And the only way you deal with fascism is abolition and defeat. And I feel like we naturalize our institutions in this country to such a degree that it is so impossible for the collective to envision another future. And I mean, I'm curious about your take on this. Like, I don't think it's uniquely American, but there is an Americanness to it that I can't really put my finger on. And that's probably just white supremacy, but.
Well, I mean, white supremacy is global, though. I do agree with you about the sort of, there's a certain Americanness to it. And I love the way you put it, the naturalization of institutions, right? We have a very particular founding myth that is very, very strong in this country, right? And that makes it, and you can tell also by how both parties argue, but especially how the right wing argues in this this day, is that there is this sort of hagiography, this like notion that America's diverse birth was somehow divine instead of a product of strenuous political strategy and action that took place over decades, right? Impressive, but nevertheless, just a product of human activity, right? Human imagination and the enactment of ideas. But that naturalization, which is imbued with a ritualistic and almost sort of divine notion, it does make it really hard for people to envision or accept or embrace that we are just as alive and just as responsible for the conditions of our living and the conditions of the living of the people who come after us as the people who were in the founding generation or any generation in between, right? But that imagination, that pragmatic imagination, that practical imagination that says this set of circumstances is not working for us as it is now. We have the power to actually alter these circumstances in a way that will benefit more of us and that will benefit people in the future. So we need to take that up. That is the thing I think that this social movement wants to do more than anything else, is to create space for that pragmatic and radical imagination that says, we don't have to live this way. We can choose differently. What we have to do is capture enough levers of power so that we can change things. And that also includes dismantling some institutions that no longer work for us and building something else that does work for us now. It's also really important to understand that this is not utopian, right? It's not about creating the perfect society for all time. It's about iterations. What we build, if we're successful in averting fascism and authoritarianism in this nation, in this generation, which is not a guarantee, but if we were successful at that, what we would build now wouldn't be good for all time. It would also have to be altered as circumstances change in future generations. And if we could build into the American common sense understanding this notion that change over time is good and will be necessary, that would do more for the longevity, I think, and benefit of, you know, this country, this continent, and the world than probably anything else.
Yeah. I'm fearful that we're a little far gone in this area, but your book does give me hope. I mean, in terms of your analysis of Black Lives Matter and you mentioned the pragmatism. I want to get into the radical Black feminist pragmatism as like the way you underpinned your analysis. But I guess I would love if you could start maybe even in 2013 talking about Trayvon Martin and all of those, like Eric Garner, Sandra Bland, the pre George Floyd murders, because something happened and then there was this massive shift. And I wonder what you attribute that to. Is that just Trump or is that and people kind of understanding, all right, we have to fight him? I don't think that's the case, how do you identify it?
Well, I think it was a confluence of a bunch of different things. And, you know, I have to say that this book is based on the interviews and observations with people who are actively involved in organizing, and that I am not an organizer in this movement. I'm a scholar, right? I'm recording this. So as I was sort of talking to people in a bunch of different organizations at a lot of different levels of leadership, you know, what became clear to me is that many of them had a similar kind of story of evolution, right? Meaning that in, you know, when the George Zimmerman verdict came down and that he would be acquitted of the murder of Trayvon Martin, a lot of people were shocked, were surprised, right? And I know that in sort of common discourse, you know, people will say kind of cynically, oh, you know, I knew it would happen, or, you know, what else could possibly happen in a racist nation, et cetera. But we were smack dab in the middle of the Obama era. Right. You know, a lot of people had sort of worked their butts off, right, to elect this person.
You can say ask. Yes.
You know, and it had been kind of their first political experience. A ton of people who it hadn't been their first political experience had not believed that there would be a Black person elected as president of the United States in their lifetime. So even though almost not very many people believed that we were in a post-racial society, for example, a lot of people did believe we had turned a major corner, right? Like that at least we were kind of on the way to something good and, or something better, right? And the Zimmerman verdict really kind of squashed that in a lot of ways for a lot of people. And it was a moment of shock. So many people that I interviewed described, you know, being in tears, being in disbelief, being in a rage, like angry, you know, all of the above, and really understanding that they needed to start to pay attention, right? That things were not actually going apace. We were not at the end of history. And indeed, we were in danger of regression, right? Some very serious regression. And so, you know, the way that it was is obviously, we know the kind of story of the founding women of Black Lives Matter Global Network Foundation and the hashtag Black Lives Matter, right, that erupted on the internet. But that was mostly a kind of social media phenomena that was happening, that was kind of raising awareness. But what it did was created community, at least online, where people started paying attention. And when and when Michael Brown was killed in Ferguson, a lot of people decided that this was the moment they were going to do something. They had been shocked by the Zimmerman verdict, but this was the moment where they were going to get involved. And so that's when you started having a proliferation of actual organizations, right? People founded organizations that had lives offline and had missions and started to be resourced and organized offline and started building capacity for what would then become the massive uprisings that happened in 2020.
Right. And as you mentioned, that's actual organizing, organizations, as opposed to, you know, we have debates with people sometimes who confuse social media activity with organizing, and that's that's untrue, and it belittles the work of organizers because it is grueling and it is very targeted. The way in which you talk about BLM being targeted is through radical Black feminist pragmatism. Now, I've danced around this, but this is such a huge part of your analysis. Could you explain radical Black feminist pragmatism, RBF,
I know, right? It's cumbersome, but each word is really important. So
I agree.
So radical is a mode of questioning, right? Like I said, radical comes from the Latin radix, which means the root, right? It's a mode of questioning that doesn't take the given as the only place that we can start, right? That says, no, let's actually look at the root or look for the root of the problem. Black feminism is an ethical system. It has deep roots in American political thought, and it is a mode of reasoning that demands that we reason from margin to center, that we take people's lived experiences as the basis for our intellectual questioning, our questions about what justice is, and that centers a kind of politics of care. And then pragmatism is a mode of judgment that guides action, right? And pragmatism here is philosophical pragmatism, not sort of political 1990s third way pragmatism, right? Like pragmatism here is, again, another sort of mode of thinking that is not utopian, right? That embraces imagination, but embraces imagination for action and assumes that as we go forward, we will have to try things, see if they're aligned with our values, And then make adjustments and try again, right? It is a politics of iteration. It involves analysis. It involves imagination, and it involves actually building in the world, right? So each one of these things is really important. So if you have the radical, which questions, right, at the root of the problem, Black feminism, which centers the marginalized and lived experience, and pragmatism, which says, hey, we've got to assess and experiment and act, then you have, I think, a really powerful framework for action that can be both effective and compassionate and transformative all at the same time.
And what ways have you seen this both be successful with BLM and then maybe not so much?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, well, this is a political philosophy, so it undergirds most of the activity in the movement, right? It's just beliefs that are widely shared. And I think one of the ways it's been successful is that it's allowed the movement to sustain itself for almost a decade, right? After being attacked at intervals, right? Attacked at intervals and then praised at other intervals, right? Throughout, as the polity's attention turns toward the activity of the movement and away, as politicians try to persecute members of the movement as a whole, to punish people who are involved in it, or to praise them and try to sort of co-opt them into sort of inside positions. Radical Black feminist pragmatism has allowed the movement to sort of be built such that it is leader full rather than having only a couple of charismatic leaders that can be removed in a variety of different ways, either by being co-opted, being assassinated, just being exhausted, right? Instead, you have a whole ethic of making sure that people who are coming up in movement organizations are able to lead, right, from where they are, and they're taught to organize other people into the movement. Although more of that can and should be done. And that's actually a huge part of what's happening. The conversations that I hear are happening right now. It's all about organizing more people and base building, actually. So that's one thing I think that this political philosophy has done. I think that and enabled to happen. But I think that, you know, movements, especially over a long period of time, right, this movement is no longer new. It's almost 10 years old.
Isn't that crazy? I know.
Over time, you know, transitions have to happen and people have to reevaluate what they think the best way forward is. And then also external conditions change, right? So it's a little bit of whiplash to go from, a little bit of like breathless media coverage of the, you know, biggest protest in U.S. history that was also the most diverse, right, for weeks on end, to the critical race theory panic, right, that has also been sort of taken seriously and fueled by media and also led to a ton of legislation, right, which the earlier praise did not lead to. Right. Not to the same degree and not without contingency. So, what radical Black feminist pragmatism has to continue to do is to allow this movement to sustain and move forward boldly, even amidst these attacks. And that's not an easy task. It has to allow the movement to continue pushing things like defund. It has to allow the movement to continue talking about housing inequality and what it might mean to, you know, give things away, right? Instead of making everything transactional, right? You know, so it has to create a context in which people can feel confident that these sort of waves of interest, disinterest, praise, scorn, persecution, or attempts at co-optation are normal phases of movement. And it's important to dig in and continue to try to push forward with the transformation of common sense, which is the thing that is really going to allow changes to happen, both in terms of concrete policy changes and in terms of changes in our living conditions.
It's about like steadiness and consistency as well, especially in the face of, and this will be my last kind of discussion point here, BLM in many ways helped Biden get elected. I mean, it was the pandemic and it was outrage about the way that the Republicans and just the country was responding to the murder of George Floyd and others. And yet there has been zero push to get rid of the filibuster in order to pass substantive legislation that would end qualified immunity, that would defund the police in any real way. In fact, Biden was promoting, let's give them more funds so they can be better at their job. The amount of strength, he didn't end up following through on that, but that was something he opined about publicly. The amount of strength that takes, it can only, you're only able to continue to move forward with this, with all of these losses stacking up, if you have a practical and consistent underpinning.
Right. And one that is really rooted in the notion that is really about creating conditions that you can care for yourself, others, and the polity, because it allows you to turn back to the question of what does it mean to do to help somebody right now? What does it mean to do to defend and save Black lives right now? What does it mean to do? What kind of things can we do in terms of mutual aid, in terms of culture work, in terms of getting new people elected, right? Like, this is not just eschewing electoral politics. It's about also turning your face away from the national, especially presidential politics, but also other national democratic politics, which is dominated, you know, by SEPTA and octogenarians who are acting based on a world that no longer exists, right? Acting out of nostalgia, right, in a large part. So it really is also about packing the decision-making bench with people who share this worldview and hoping that you get there before get there. And when I say get there, I mean get to positions of power in which you can protect your communities and push new policy and institutional arrangements forward before, before devolution into right, authoritarianism and fascism.
Yeah, there will be a new fascist at least in the primary in 2024 nationally, and then of course we have these kinds of strengths and systems are immensely important. So I really appreciate your work here, Diva Woodley, associate professor of politics at the New School for Social Research and author of Reckoning: Black Lives Matter and the Democratic Necessity of Social Movements. Can't thank you enough for your time today. Really appreciate
it. It's been a pleasure.
Absolutely. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. Come back, wrap up the first hour of the program. We are back, and that brings us to the end of the first hour of the Majority Report. But first, before we head into the fun half, take your calls, take your IMs. What's happening on Left Reckoning, Matt?
Well, we had a really good discussion with Jason and Pascal last week, but for patrons, yesterday we released the second part of our Karl Marx reading series. We're taking the essays of Karl Marx pretty much chronologically. So we did his two-part essay on the Jewish question. The first part is an insanely ahead of its time defense of the right of Jews to experience full political rights, despite, as some Christians were saying at that time, some folks were saying they need to liberate themselves from their religion before they ask for, you know, things like voting rights and stuff like that. Marx was against that. And then part two is a very kind of problematic portion where Marx sort of yes-ends a lot of anti-Semitic tropes to try to accuse Western civilization of being being the true money grubbers. And we get into that, and also Marx's an anti-Semitic letter Marx wrote. So we get into the problematic Marx, but we also get into the important thing to know about that essay, which is he was on the right side of history, defending Jewish folks to have political rights. Marx himself was a grandson of two rabbis. His father had converted around the time Marx was born because there was a lot of anti-Jewish sentiment that basically meant, like, again, like political rights. You need to, if you want to continue having a business, you got to lose the Judaism. So we get into that history of Marx. So Marx on the Jewish Question, patreon.com/leftreckoning to get me and David discussing that.
Amazing. All right. Well, we are going to head into the fun half now, taking your call, 646-257-3920. See you then.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, yeah. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back, and the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back, and the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just wanna degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back, back, back. Back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back, back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare!
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Denner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them, fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bang. Hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back, 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 back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them. Fuck them. Things I do for the bigger game plan. By the way, it's my birthday.
My birthday.
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy.
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on. To pay the price of blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.